Your Honor, judges, may it please the court. My name is Patrick Ridley, and I'm here with Kristen Frost. Kevin Donnelly and Frank Carrada are also here on behalf of the appellants, Richard Anderson being the lead plaintiff appellant, and he appears as well. Your Honors, this case is about whether or not the transaction that essentially involved HCA paying $1.45 billion to the foundation in order to buy out their interest is in violation of principles of charitable trust law, and whether the case should be sent back to the Attorney General for the court to apply those principles to determine, first of all, whether, as indicated by Judge Jones below, one of the primary purposes of the HCA Health One Company and the merger back in 1995 was to reflect the interests of Colorado citizenry and to have the foundation have a veto power, in effect, over the decision-making process of its for-profit partner, HCA. There's been discussion in the briefs about whether this case is moot or what really happens and whether what has happened can be undone. I think it's important to talk a little bit about the details of the transaction and to talk about what we think happens if the OAG analyzes this case is under the case law that we've talked about establishes that a fundamental principle of charitable trust law is that if the mission of the organization is capable of continuing to be achieved and fulfilled, then a transaction of this sort should not be approved, which fundamentally alters the mission of the company. In this case, the charitable trust, which was HCA Health One. That mission we assert, and it's supported by principally Richard Anderson's letter writing that's a part of the record, an affidavit that's a part of the record, that demonstrates that the reason for the existence of this entity is because the foundation, the Colorado Health Foundation, would only agree to merge with what at the time was Columbia, what subsequently became HCA, if it, the nonprofit, had the ability to veto decision-making powers of the joint venture. And so when what I'm going to refer to as the joint venture, when the joint venture was formed, the Colorado Health Foundation had equal membership on the board of directors. What that means is that either party, the foundation at any time was able to veto the decision making of the for-profit HCA. The for-profit HCA was able to veto any decision making of the foundation. That's critical. That's the non-charitable purpose here, which was the factor that led to the creation of this entity back in 1995. What the transaction here does is HCA ends up paying the Colorado Health Foundation $1.45 billion. What the foundation gives up is its membership in the joint venture. It gives up the percentage, the amount of units that it owned in the joint venture. In terms of what happened and the timing of this lawsuit and the timing of the closing, what happens is on October 13th, I think it is, the Office of Attorney General approves the transaction. The same day, the transaction is finalized. To be sure, when the Attorney General reviewed the transaction, it made certain, it negotiated on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado certain concessions that related to the continuation of charitable care, to the fact that hospitals couldn't be closed for an additional 5 years, the 7 hospitals in the metropolitan area that are part of this joint venture. What happens at that point is that, the money goes to the foundation, HCA gets control, and then about 30 days later, the plaintiffs bring this lawsuit. At the time the lawsuit is brought on the 15th of November, there's press about it. There is, it's a fairly significant lawsuit because it's trying to undo a $1.45 billion transaction.
Let me ask you a question about that. In your complaint, you allege 2 injuries. One, as you pointed out, the withdrawal of the foundation from the management of the system, and therefore the withdrawal of its charitable purpose in monitoring of the system.
Yes.
You also allege that the tax-exempt status of the foundation may at some point be at risk.
Correct.
Okay. You appear to be challenging in the lawsuit, in the trial court, and in this court, that the Office of the Attorney General, in reviewing the transaction, should have applied the Hospital Transfer Act.
That's correct, Your
Honor. Which the OAG issued an opinion saying it would not.
Right.
My understanding of the pleadings and the briefs at this point is that there's no request now that the transaction be modified or voided.
Your Honor, the request is that the Office of Attorney General re-examine this case in line with the cases that we've cited, the Moore case, the Dunbar case, the Henry Manhattan Ear, Eye, Ear, and Throat Hospital case. And if it's our view that if the Office of Attorney General looks at whether this mission of continuing to have veto power, a nonprofit continuing to have veto power over a for-profit company, the Office of Attorney General will have a very, very difficult time coming to any other conclusion but that.
Okay, let's assume I agree with you, and let's assume I tell the Attorney General, whose staff I think is present, that you were wrong in ignoring the act. Now, what happens? They go back, they do this evaluation again, and they determine they were wrong. And they say, we should have considered the act. Now what?
If they determine that they were wrong, and they look at this and they say that this transaction violates the charitable purpose of the joint venture, then they should order that the transaction be unwound.
Well, you've insisted throughout the proceeding and resisted the joinder of the two parties to the transaction. You've insisted that's not the remedy you're seeking. You keep insisting you just want the Attorney General to re-review the matter under the statute.
But in re-reviewing it, the Attorney General has 2 choices, right? Either they say we re-reviewed it and we approve it, or we reviewed it anew, and we reject the transaction. That's one of the 2 natural consequences that are going to flow from the decision.
But the transaction is closed, the money's been paid, and HCA has now been running the hospitals for some time.
Right.
And so the foundation is going to be forced to pay back the $1.45 billion and return to its management role?
The foundation, my understanding is they've never really managed the operation. The management of the operation has always been conducted by HCA.
Well, they have veto power. They'll come back with
they have veto power, for sure, and that's what we're asking for. Right. Okay. So let's talk about that. I mean, that's where the rubber hits the road.
Well, let's talk about where we're going with this case.
Right.
Because if, as I understand it, you do not anticipate the transaction being unwound, then there's nothing that's going to happen that's going to correct the damages or injuries you allege. And then that raises the question of why are we here?
Your Honor, if the Attorney General looks at this transaction again under the Colorado Hospital Transfer Act and under the principles of charitable trust law that I've talked about and makes the determination that this transaction does not comport with the Hospital Transfer Act or generally accepted principles of charitable trust law, it's duty bound to unwind the transaction. As a practical matter, there's a lot of discussion about how difficult it is going to be to unwind the transaction, Your Honor. To be sure, the Colorado Health Foundation is going to have to return $1.45 billion to HCA. And HCA has to put them, has to restore their ownership interest, the number of units they had previously. There's nothing in the record beyond that that really demonstrates a level of difficulty to this. Indeed, when the Colorado Health Foundation issued their press release on October 14th, they said that our mission isn't going to change and we're going to continue to do the same things that we've been doing. To be sure, they wanted diversification, they've got more money, they've got more money for grants, but they have been doing what they've always done, which is promoting the mission of making Colorado the healthiest state in the nation. We don't know whether they spent more money than they did prior to this transaction. If they spent more money, we don't know how much. In terms of what's happened with HCA, HCA has continued to operate the hospital. They may have made decisions that were the foundation involved, the foundation may not have approved. We're not asking that those things be undone if the AG thinks that the transaction has to be run. Prospectively going forward, the foundation would go back to its position of protecting the interests of the Colorado citizenry to ensure that there's a nonprofit voice that prevents HCA from engaging in decisions that are principally motivated.
Well, Council, I don't want to argue with you, but I think you're oversimplifying the matter. Let's assume, for purposes of argument only, that the hospitals are now worth twice what they were at the time of the transaction.
Okay.
HCA is going to be required to sell back half the $1.45 billion. Or the reciprocal. The hospitals have not been well managed in the interim, and they're worth much less than they were at the time of the transaction. The foundation have to pay $1.45 billion for a system that's not worth that, half
yes.
of which is not worth that.
If the transaction was unwound, presumptively, that's what would happen. $1.45 billion would have to be exchanged. But there was valuation, there was testimony and evidence about the fair market value when the Office of Attorney General initially looked at this. I don't think there's anything to prevent the Office of Attorney General from, you know, conducting that analysis about fair market value, and if there's been a change, to have an adjustment of the $1.45 billion.
So it's your position that the Attorney General continues to have jurisdiction over the transaction and over the HCA hospital system for purposes of re-reviewing it? The jurisdiction may be the wrong term.
Yeah,
but, I mean,
they have authority.
Has the authority to do
that. Yeah, I think so. Part of the agreement is that the Office of Attorney General demanded that HCA provide annual reports for the next 10 years. So the Office of Attorney General is already involved in the transaction. I'm not aware of any law that would prevent the Office of Attorney General to look at it again, and to exercise the type of authority that we've been talking about here.
So you want us to look at this case as though if you were successful, this transaction stands substantial risk of being modified or voided?
Correct. Okay. That's a natural consequence of the Office of Attorney General, you know, looking at it under principles of charitable trust law and the Colorado Hospital Transfer Act, coming to the conclusion that the transaction violates those two bodies of law.
Mr.
Councilman,
go ahead. I guess I'm interested in the failure to seek any sort of injunctive type relief to prevent the transaction from occurring. I understand the timing, but there was notice a month before that the AG wasn't going to apply the Hospital Transfer Act. And so why wasn't there some effort to, I mean, it could be anticipated that the transaction would occur shortly after the approval. And so why weren't efforts made to to prevent the transaction from occurring?
Your Honor, the record is very silent on that issue. There's not a lot of information on the record reflecting why there wasn't an injunctive relief. I've investigated, I've tried to figure out why that is, and as best I could tell the court, there was really no good reason to not seek injunctive relief, and I'm not sure that there was a bad reason for not seeking injunctive relief. One of the things that Judge Jump talked about is that there was no direct notice of the lawsuit to HCA and the foundation. And it's true because they weren't brought into the case. But I think that between the press concerning the lawsuit that was filed in November of 2011, and the fact that we know from HCA's billing records that on I think November 18th, a couple of days after the case was filed, they started doing work on the case. And it strains. As a practical reality, as much time as the Attorney General spent with HCA and with the foundation trying to work out this deal, it certainly makes sense they would have had indirect knowledge of it. I see I've got about 8 minutes and 50 seconds left. Unless the court has a question for me, I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal on Ms. Ross.
I have a question. Despite the fact that the AG's office said on September 8th, 2011, that the act does not apply to the transaction and that he would exercise his common law authority to review the transaction, the decision of the Attorney General specifically says in paragraph 1, the Attorney General has reviewed the transaction pursuant to the Hospital Transfer Act, CRS 619-101, and the Attorney General's common law authority over charitable trusts. And yet you're asking that the Attorney General's office re-review under the Hospital Transfer Act when it seems by the express provisions of its decision that it did apply or at least consider this transaction under the factors in the Hospital Transfer Act.
I read the opinion a little differently, and the way I read it is that they found that the act doesn't apply, but they're generally going to look at the Hospital Transfer Act. And what they did is they listed six factors that they were going to consider in their evaluation. What they don't list is whether or not the transaction is contrary to the mission of the joint venture, which is to have a veto power by the Colorado Health Foundation against HCA. That's not listed as a factor. To be sure, that's common law charitable trust instruments, but I didn't read that order as saying that the Attorney General strictly adhered to the Colorado Hospital Transfer Act.
Okay, and you're down to less than 7 minutes, so I'll let you go, but I will note that one of the factors that the Attorney General says it relied upon or focused on was the foundation must maintain its historic charitable mission and function. So why isn't that a consideration of what you said was just left out?
It's a terrific question, Your Honor. And the reason is because that's the foundation that has now been divested from the joint venture. So what the AG says is as far as the future of the foundation, which is no longer a part of this entity, it's not just HCA, they're saying we're going to continue to make sure the foundation continues in its charitable operations. They don't say that HCA and the new continuing entity has to continue in its charitable mission.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Eric Kuhn, registration number 38083. I represent Colorado Attorney General John Southers. And I'm joined this morning by Troy Ide, who represents the Colorado Health Foundation, and Sean Gallagher, who represents the HCA companies. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes of my argument so that Mr. Ide and Mr. Gallagher can discuss the concerns unique to their clients. The judgment of dismissal in this case should be affirmed. As the court knows from our briefs, we also argue that on alternative grounds to affirm the judgments on standing, which I'll address very briefly unless the court has questions. In any of the four complaints that the plaintiffs have brought, they never allege that they themselves are harmed by this transaction. Instead, they allege that they, as members of the public, may be harmed in the event that the hospital transaction results in a change in character to the hospital system, but they never specify what that change in character would be. And that injury that they claim is simply too remote and too speculative under Colorado's injury in fact constitutional requirements. But unless the court has questions on those issues, I'll turn to a discussion of mootness.
But don't they allege that they suffer a, I believe, a procedural injury? I think that's what they allege. That suffice to give them standing if they say that they have been injured by the process or the procedure followed by the Attorney General's office.
Judge, I would say that's not enough under Colorado's Wimberly in fact test. The case law that they cite, the Clayton Act and the NEPA, are specialized procedural acts that by their very terms say that unless you walk through this exact statutory procedure, then the plaintiffs can bring an action to halt the government action. And those are both federal acts. The Hospital Transfer Act is discretionary, provides no explicit procedure. And the plaintiffs never allege, they never allege any injury to themselves. So we would say that that procedural injury theory is inapplicable.
Okay.
So turning to the issue of mootness, the district court issued a well-reasoned opinion that walked through the DeVilbiss factors, weighed the facts in this case, and determined that under the facts of this case, the case was moot and should be dismissed. And the first DeVilbiss factor goes to whether or not a plaintiff sought preliminary or temporary injunctive relief. As Judge Boris's question highlighted, in this case, it's undisputed that the plaintiffs did not seek to maintain the status quo pending review on the merits. As your question also highlighted, there was a 5-week window between when the Attorney General announced that the Hospital Transfer Act did not apply to the facts of this case and when the transaction itself closed. And during that window, the plaintiffs could have either sought to maintain the status quo, to block the transaction, or at the very least, to develop a strategy. But it also ignores the host of options that the plaintiffs had available to them after the transaction closed. They could simply have sought preliminary or temporary injunctive relief. And Rule 65, by its own terms, says that an injunction can be mandatory if necessary to grant plaintiff relief.
Even if the transaction is already closed?
Yes, Judge. And there's an important distinction. The transaction closed, and at that very moment, when $500 million had changed hands and a membership interest had gone the other way. But many months after that is when the transaction is being implemented. And I'll let the parties talk about exactly how that worked for them. But even after the transaction had closed, the district court had the power to enter a mandatory injunction to freeze the situation or to even have them pass those two things back. The complication in this case is not the actual closing of the transaction, but the events that happen subsequent that make it very difficult to unwind at this point.
What would you expect the bond requirements to be on an injunction in joining a $1.5 billion transaction?
Judge, honestly, I have no idea what the results of that would be.
I mean, it seems to me, as a practical matter, that's a theoretical remedy. I mean, very few people can come up with one. $1 billion. It may not have to be the whole purchase price, but normally it's a substantial percentage.
Judge, I would say that the district court would have discretion in determining what the bond amount would be, and that an appropriate bond amount would be an amount that secured, it was a significant amount for the plaintiffs, not necessarily an aggregate review. Obviously, there's
no way. And what form of action do you believe could have been brought prior, during this interim period, between either the public announcement of the transaction or whatever, to enjoin the matter?
They certainly could have brought simply an injunction action. They could have sought a Rule 106 action, claiming that there's no other remedy available to them, and they wanted a court to review the application of the HTA before it was too late because the transaction was going to close. But speaking to your bond point, the other option they had available to them, both under Rule 106 and the State Administrative Procedure Act, was to seek a stay of the Attorney General's decision. As far as I know, that doesn't require a bond. And if they had joined HCA and the Colorado Health Foundation and asked the district court for a stay under either the rule or the statute, it would have had the same effect. The AG's approval would have been stayed, the parties would have been joined, and they would have maintained the status quo. And the other key piece for DeVildis and the first DeVildis factor is there's no requirement that the plaintiffs are successful in obtaining an injunction. The language in DeVildis is that they sought, so that they tried to do something. The plaintiffs in this case didn't take any action.
Didn't the Supreme Court make it pretty clear that that case should be narrowly applied and perhaps only to its own facts?
The court did limit the holding in that case, but reading the language of the case, it speaks in general terms, as in a court who's faced with a situation can weigh these factors and determine that an action is moot and should be dismissed. We argue that the reason the Supreme Court issued such a lengthy decision with such a lengthy explication of the factors is because it intended it to be a precedential value. So those are the reasons that the district court found that the first to build this factor weighed in favor of the defendants and against reviewing the transaction. And the second factor looks at the defendant's behavior in moving forward with the challenged transaction. It's important to note that the defendants in this case didn't do anything that was impermissible or illegal or improper in moving forward with their transaction. They negotiated a business deal between them, and because it involved nonprofit hospital assets, they brought it to the Attorney General for review. The Attorney General engaged in a four-month intensive public review period. He personally conducted two public hearings, hundreds of emails were reviewed, and at the end of that period, after obtaining public input, the Attorney General determined that there were a number of conditions that had to be placed onto the transaction in the interest of Colorado citizens to strengthen. So the Attorney General and the parties sat down and negotiated exactly what changes to their business deal would satisfy his conditions. And after that discussion, the parties modified their transaction. The Attorney General issued his decision contingent on satisfying the conditions, and then the parties closed their transaction. But it's that natural course of business, natural course of dealings, that's what led to the parties being ready to close shortly after the decision was issued.
Jurisdiction in this case seems to be premised on Rule 106A4, on the Administrative Procedures Statute, which also seems to have 106A4, and the Hospital Transfer Act provisions with respect to the Attorney General and review of the Attorney General's decision under the Act, which I think contemplates that he would bring an enforcement action, not the outside parties. Is there jurisdiction under any of the three premises alleged?
The district court only found jurisdiction under Rule 106, and
that's not my question. My question is there a jurisdictional basis couched as an appeal? This case is couched as an appeal.
Right, Judge.
Okay. Is there an appeal from what the Attorney General did? Either under any of the three bases alleged.
So, Judge, to answer your question, which we certainly haven't briefed here and I haven't reviewed since the trial court arguments, we argue that certainly these plaintiffs are not in the position to appeal. The Hospital Transfer Act doesn't provide for anyone other than proponents to a transaction, if those proponents are unsatisfied with the results, to bring a challenge. And there appears to be no application of the Hospital Transfer Act also by its terms characterizes this kind of review as a quasi-legislative instead of a quasi-judicial action, which would take it out of 106 and the Administrative Procedure Act. So under the exact facts of this case, we've argued before that there's no jurisdiction.
But you're dropping that argument here?
No.
Maybe raise it.
If that's your question, then I absolutely, I swear we don't, there's no jurisdiction.
Thank you.
Yes.
I know we're eating into your co-counsel's time here, but I'll ask you the same question that I asked of Mr. Ridley about the Attorney General's decision and the apparent inconsistency between the Attorney General's statement that he does not believe the transaction is governed by the HTA, but then saying in the decision that he has reviewed the transaction pursuant to the HTA and his common law authority over charitable trust. How do you explain that? Did the Attorney General apply the provisions of the HTA in reaching this decision?
I have two answers, Judge.
Or not?
The first answer is that the Attorney General did evaluate the transaction under the HTA and found that under the strict terms of that act, the act itself did not apply. But then he took the essential criteria and his common law authority and completed the review instead. And so, yes, he reviewed the transaction using all of the HTA criteria, but he also determined that the act itself did not apply.
Thank you.
The third Bilbis factor looks at what the interest would be if the transaction, what the interest affected would be if the transaction moved forward. And the district court correctly noted that there's no evidence in the record that the parade of horribles feared by the plaintiffs has come to pass since the transaction moved forward. The plaintiff's counsel countered that there's no evidence in the record it would be any more difficult than passing $1.5 billion back to one side and an LLC interest back to the other. But it's difficult to conceive of a more complicated transaction to undo than a $1.5 billion sale of a 7-hospital healthcare system that occurred at this point almost 2 years ago. And I'll let the parties talk about the harms that their clients suffered or would suffer if this transaction were undone. But our position is that the district court correctly construed this factor. So having found all three factors weighed in favor of the defendants and against review, the district court correctly found this case was moot and dismissed it. And the plaintiffs have advanced a number of other arguments. Judge Rory, your question highlighted one of them, which is their continuing shifting relief that they sought. And I think we heard this morning that at this point they do expect that the transaction could be unwound.
Am I the only one in the room surprised by that?
No, Judge. So, and if that's the case, as Your Honor points out, whether it is a one step the district court directly unwinds the transaction or two step the district court orders the Attorney General to unwind the transaction, in either case, the harm to the parties is just as real. And the mootness criteria should be applied with equal force, and there should be no change in due to that argument. The last thing that I want to highlight for this court is the only reason that this case is in the current procedural posture is because of the strategic decisions of the plaintiffs. It's the plaintiffs who failed to seek to maintain the status quo, either through an injunction or through a stay. And the plaintiffs are the only ones who fought for 9 months to keep the indispensable parties from being joined in this case.
Let me ask you this. If, in fact, they are not seeking an unwinding of the transaction, or at least their pleadings don't support that that's what they're seeking, is the case moot for that reason?
Yes, Judge, it is. Because if they're seeking simply to have the decision handed back to the Attorney General with instructions that he applied the law wrong, but there's no chance that the transaction will be unwound, then that's nothing more than an advisory opinion. In that case, there's no case in controversy, and that also is moot under this case, under Colorado law. So either way, whether they do want the transaction at risk or not, the case remains moot. So what I would say is that it's the plaintiffs who have the burden in this case. And the plaintiffs are the only ones who failed to meet the burden. That's the only reason that we're here. So unless the court has other questions for me, the Attorney General urges the court to affirm the judgment of dismissal and I'll turn your argument over to Troy Hyde.
Hey, please the court, Troy Hyde, 21164, counsel for the Colorado Health Foundation. Andy Warover, our president and CEO, is in the courtroom with me. I was recently admonished by another court for speaking too quickly, but I'm looking at this clock, so please bear with me. I just have a couple points to make. Number one, I stipulate to what my colleague has said about mootness. This is a textbook mootness case, I would say. There's nothing that this court can do, respectfully, that can resolve the underlying controversy, given that the AG really is the one that had the authority to make the decisions that he did. And I would cite the Tesmer case from 2006 of this court to that proposition. I'll just tell you in all candor, I kept waiting to see what the folks would do on the other side of this case. I mean, I was involved in this deal from the beginning, and I didn't know if they would sue. I figured they probably wouldn't, because there had been so many statements during the process about how well the process was working, which, of course, the record reflects. But eventually, the 30 days ran. We had closed the transaction, but I want to correct the idea that there was somehow some ambiguity as to the closing. I mean, there's no question, as a matter of historical fact, as Judge Jones found, that this transaction closed shortly after the AG approved it. Now, it was very shortly, and I would just say the reason for that was the iterative process that we followed. Starting in June.
Let me ask you a question on an unrelated matter, since your time is short. There seems to be some argument that the trust violated, or this transaction violates, the terms of the trust. And I gather that arises from the trust amended its purposes in its corporate documents, whatever they are,
at the time
of the transaction to permit this transaction.
No, Your Honor. And it's a great point to raise, sir. And I just say the panel needs to understand that the Colorado Health Foundation was created in 1995. Its charitable purpose and mission was set forth in bylaws, section 1.2. They have never changed. And in fact, the AG's decision specifically stipulates and requires, and the parties agreed as a condition of closing, that mission can never change unless the AG approves a change in the bylaws.
And that's the foundation's purpose.
It's the foundation's purpose.
There's no argument here, at least I haven't seen an argument here, that the trust was acting in any way in an ultra vires way and selling its interest in this business.
No, sir. We were trying to stabilize our assets. I mean, and just to the point of injury at this point, 23 months later, you know, we have since, as a matter of judicial notice on our website, we made 372 grants totaling almost $150 million in statewide and in 41 counties as well. I mean, this, and the way we can do this, sir, is because the we're no longer dependent on hospitals solely as the major source of revenue. We diversified the portfolio, and so the entire asset structure of this foundation has changed significantly. And that was, of course, what the AG found as a desirable outcome of this whole process, was that we were too dependent on one source of revenue that was volatile.
And so unwinding the transaction would cause the foundation to sell assets so they could pay back the $1.45 billion or some number approaching that.
They not to sell them, we'd actually have to restructure the entire asset portfolio in terms of how the assets are structured. There are groups of assets based on different risk factors. We have a much more conservative portfolio than we did when we relied on a healthcare market that was producing very strong returns, as you all know, for many years, and now with healthcare reform is just volatile. We don't know, we can't predict what it will be like in the future. So I wanted to just, simply because I need to turn this over to my colleague, I wanted to just stress that our charitable purpose was not abandoned, contrary to what I saw in the opening brief. I also wanted to read from the AG's opinion in September with respect to HCA's purpose and governance, because my learned colleague here made this point. The AG concluded on page 6, quote, that the fundamental shift away from hospital governance on the part of the foundation has occurred over time since 1995, when the LLC was formed. I just want to say that at the time that back in 95, that there was this joint venture created, the role of the foundation is quite different than it is today and of course now. It was in a governance role for a while, and of course an important role, but over time it became more and more focused, as would have been expected, on this charitable mission. And HCA has been the manager since 1995. There's been no change in that. They've always run the venture.
We've never been a foundation run by a group of doctors and so on. We've always had this charitable mission of trying to promote health and wellness in Colorado. So the structure really has not changed, and it was incremental from 1995 until 2011. And so I wanted to correct that part of it, as well as the issue about, as I mentioned, the timing.
Did the foundation own one or more of the hospitals that became a part of this joint venture?
Yeah, it was a conversion foundation originally, and that is to say, there was, and this is back in those days that we had a hospital transfer act, it could have applied back then, but in 1995. The idea was that these were a group of nonprofit hospitals, and then the foundation was created when a for-profit entity was formed. HCA was the manager that always run the hospitals. We always had, the foundation always had a minority stake in that venture. This was just an asset for us. We wanted to be able to sell the asset because the risk profile was too dangerous, frankly, for the mission. You know, we are one of the largest providers of for underinsured people's insurance coverage in the state, so it's very important to have that be stable because so many county health departments rely on what we do. I see my time is expiring. No further questions. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Sean Gallagher. I represent HCA. Judge Roy, I want to spend my remaining time answering a couple of questions that you posed during the earlier arguments. During Mr. Ives' argument, you talked about you asked him about the effects of restructuring and what would that have. What effects might that have if the court ordered that the transaction be unwound? I think it's important for the court to recognize that we're not just talking about an accounting transaction here where one check would be written back to the Health Foundation and everybody would be put back into the status quo. The Health Foundation, according to their website and according to their mission, has taken to spending funds and committing to funding not-for-profits and other entities and organizations and efforts in Colorado based upon this expectation that they have this funding available. If suddenly the funds have to be returned to HCA, that is by necessity going to have downstream effects throughout the state. There will be charitable organizations that have applied for grants that premise or base their activities upon an assumption that grant money is coming, and if that money is not there to be paid, it's not just an accounting transaction. The effects of unwinding this transaction would ripple throughout the state of Colorado. Second, Your Honor, you mentioned the question of jurisdiction, and Mr. Kuhn indicated that jurisdiction had been raised in the district court. Certainly it has not been briefed in the trial court, but as this court is certainly aware, jurisdiction is a necessary antecedent to any other issue that arises in this case, and should the court have concerns about whether it has jurisdiction, that's an issue that needs to be raised and addressed head on. So the fact that it hasn't been briefed on appeal does not mean that the issue of jurisdiction is not properly before the court, because it is necessarily antecedent to everything the court does. The issue of jurisdiction is properly before the court. Finally, Your Honor, you posed the question about a bond, and that is a fascinating question. It's something that we haven't researched and that we haven't briefed. But I suspect the question had to do with, could the plaintiffs have sought injunctive relief? Because if they did, they'd have to post a bond. Who in the world could post a $1.45 billion bond?
Mr. Buffett.
Well, and there are probably others, but there aren't very many people. And query whether Mr. Buffett would be willing to post a $1.45 billion bond. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the court would require a $1.45 billion bond. In fact, if the injunction was directed against the Attorney General, against a public entity, it's typically not necessary to post a bond. In a constitutional challenge, when you bring a claim under Section 1983 or even a claim under the U.S. Constitution seeking injunctive relief, courts typically don't require you to post a bond. So I wouldn't suggest that the requirement that a bond be posted is an excuse or a reason why the plaintiffs did not seek injunctive relief. In fact, quite frankly, there's been no discussion whatsoever from the plaintiffs that they decided not to seek injunctive relief because they did not post a bond. This, ultimately, Your Honor, is a case about choice. It's a case about tactical choices that the plaintiffs made. The plaintiffs chose to allege that they, rather than the Attorney General, were the appropriate parties to represent the interests of the people of the state of Colorado. They chose to hire Mr. Horowitz, a very skilled and capable lawyer with significant experience in this very issue of Hospital Transfer Act. They chose to participate in the Attorney General's review process. They chose to file suit after the completion of that process. they chose how they would characterize the relief that they were seeking in this case. Quite frankly, we didn't really get to the bottom of it until this hearing here today. And they chose not to name the foundation or HCA as defendants. And they chose not to seek injunctive relief. And now they're complaining that the court has, that the district court has dismissed their case as moot. But quite frankly, that decision may very well be the consequences of their own tactical decisions. And for that reason, we ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court. If there are no further questions, I thank the court.
Thank you. Counsel?
Dale, would you add 2 minutes to counsel's time for rebuttal? Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Kristen Frost for the appellants in this case. Your Honors, I'd like to first address the OEG's argument regarding standing and the injury in this case. I would point the court to the Dick Anderson memorandum that's contained in the record, the affidavit from Dick Anderson, who is present here in court today with us. I would point to the position paper that the group of plaintiffs tendered to the Office of Attorney General in this case. Those documents, and there's other correspondence from an attorney named Richard Hennessy that were sent to the Office of the Attorney General at various times before the October 13th decision, in which Mr. Hennessy or Mr. Anderson is pleading the Office of the Attorney General to fulfill its statutory obligation to apply the Hospital Transfer Act and to apply to principles of charitable trust law. Those correspondence and all the information from Dick Anderson demonstrate the injury that the plaintiff suffered in this case. And Judge Jones noted that. Judge Jones addressed standing. He found that the director plaintiffs had suffered a quote-unquote unique type of harm based on the unique position that the director plaintiffs have to the genesis and purpose of the trust.
As I recall, well, first two things. The trial judge threw out the other group of plaintiffs.
Yes.
I know those, some, apparently some of their names remain in the caption. They're not here before us. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
My understanding.
And second, the court seemed to find standing for your, for the, what I call the director plaintiffs, on a public interest standing basis. And I'm not aware that Colorado has adopted that.
And Your Honor, I do agree that Colorado has not adopted a general public interest standing. Colorado is more strict than other states, yet more liberal than federal cases on standing. However, Judge Jones actually distinguished the directors from the public at large based on their unique relationship and involvement with the creation of the joint venture and the foundation since 1995. These director plaintiffs have been involved for almost 20 years at that point, and that was the key distinction, their special unique relationship in which Judge Jones used.
But does that special relationship cause them any injury or damage other than that which would be suffered by the general public, which is alluded to in the papers, and the people who are seeking hospital care in the state of Colorado?
And again, I would agree that yes, it does, and they are different from the general public and have suffered a distinct injury.
What is the distinct injury?
The fact that Dick Anderson and his colleagues negotiated the creation of the joint venture, the fact that someone like Dick Anderson and his colleagues sat on a board of directors for years with the specific purpose that the foundation continue its charitable mission, that the joint venture continue this charitable mission to make sure that the citizens of Colorado are not run by an out-of-state for-profit organization, but that they have a veto power and an interest. Dick Anderson and his colleagues are the ones sitting there to make sure that that charitable purpose is fulfilled. That's the injury, because once the OAG does not apply principles of charitable trust law, once the OAG violates its statutory duties to be the gatekeeper of charitable trusts in this entire state for the people of Colorado, that veto power goes away. Dick Anderson and his colleagues then have suffered an injury, I'm sorry, and that is different from the public at large.
Well, the OAG is a political office, and so why isn't their violation of their duties as a public officer a political question instead of something of a special relationship standing?
And again, Your Honor, I would just point you to the statutory requirements that the Office of Attorney General has, which is unique as a guardian of public trust in Colorado, where the public is the beneficiary of the trust.
I'm not going to let you sit down without discussing jurisdiction under Rule 106B4, the statute, and the Hospital Transfer Act, which are the three bases for your appellate jurisdiction, which is what you're seeking. Appears to be what you're seeking.
Yes, Your Honor. May I address one more point on standing before I address
that? You can say anything you want now, but I want you to answer those questions before you sit down.
Okay. Let's go back to that question then. Because I don't want to sit down.
Pardon?
I said, can we go back to the question about 106 jurisdiction?
Well, 106A4 deals with quasi-judicial proceedings.
Yes.
It appears here that the proceeding that the Attorney General undertook was a fact-finding. And he was not adjudicating anybody's rights that were appearing before him. So if it's not quasi-judicial, is there any jurisdiction under 106A4?
Yes, and actually that was addressed by Judge Jones as well. He found that they were acting as a legislative body and making that decision, and that they weren't sitting in some kind of quasi-capacity, if you will.
He found jurisdiction under 106, the rule.
Yes.
And he found jurisdiction on the basis that it was a quasi-judicial proceeding, as I recall the order.
Yes, and I think I just misspoke. I meant Judge Jones found that they were acting as a judicial, quasi-judicial body, rendering a decision that was then appealable and reviewable, and that Judge Jones had jurisdiction.
So every time an administrative agency makes a factual inquiry in order to make a decision about a matter submitted to it, that is a quasi-judicial proceeding, in your view?
Well, we would argue it wasn't a factual inquiry, Your Honor, that they were actually, according to the OAG's own admission, in which they're now here before this court, asking this court to uphold, they were making determinations about whether the Hospital Transfer Act applied, whether it did not. They alluded to the fact that they were trying to consider principles of charitable trust law. They are applying law to the facts. This wasn't a scenario where it was a fact-finding mission, you know, analogous to a tribunal type of situation, which I think would be the distinction between when an administrative body acts as a legislative, in a legislative capacity, versus in a quasi-judicial or judicial capacity. And I would just point the court to the fact that none of the defendants had raised that issue in the briefs, and naturally, the court is free to ask me that before I sit down, but...
Well, it's a jurisdictional question, and I can't speak for my colleagues being the junior member of the division, but I'm sure if you wanted to write us a letter on that subject, we'd be willing to read it.
Is the court asking me to brief him?
Well, that's up to the man sitting in the middle.
So I would turn my attention to the prestigious man in the middle and ask if he would require us to brief that issue.
You want some briefing on the jurisdiction under 106A4?
Well, under the three jurisdictional statutes alleged or asserted in the complaint, it has not been an uncommon practice for us to ask for a letter, not a full brief,
yes,
addressed to the members of the division, so it doesn't go through our very efficient clerk's office, but comes through the office. And then we can consider it in considering the case.
And we'd be happy to do that, Your Honor.
If you would submit such a letter, not to exceed, since you're going to ask for three basis under three, or jurisdictional basis under three different principles, 10 pages.
10 pages with simultaneous letter from the parties.
From the opposing parties also. If you could do that simultaneously,
not in response, but just simultaneously. And if you can file that within a week.
Sure.
Can you do that by next Wednesday?
Sure, yes.
Thank you.
We took up a lot of your time. Do you want to restore some of our time?
About adding another minute. Well, we're in the negative now going up. We'll go one more minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. And, you know, going to that point of why the OIG was acting in a judicial capacity, it's because the OIG made an error of law. And that's why we're here. That's what we're stating. They made a, it's been no surprise throughout this entire case. It's been clear from the moment the first complaint was filed that they committed legal error and it needs to be reversed. In terms of the skipping over to the foundation and HCA's arguments about the burden they have suffered because they weren't named in the case originally, first of all, I would point out that this is the first time we're hearing from the foundation that 372 grants statewide have been funded since the beginning of this case. That was not in the brief. And I will point the court's attention to the fact that neither the foundation nor the HCA ever alleged any evidence about the burden and about what has occurred since then. They spent a lot of time talking about how the plaintiffs should have named them in an injunction originally, how they were prejudiced because they allegedly were part of the original 106 action for 9 months, but they never give us any specific facts or evidence as to whether the money has been spent. If the money's been spent, where is some of the $1.45 billion gone? And quite frankly, how is, for instance, when Mr. Ide mentioned 372 grants, how is that different from what they did beforehand?
You have about 20 seconds.
Okay. I would submit that there's no burden and that doesn't necessitate unwinding in this case. I would lastly point out, and this goes to Judge Barras, a question you asked earlier about why the plaintiffs, you know.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you. I will happily sit down now.
Because we have granted an additional several minutes to the appellant, would one of the appellees have any remarks not to exceed 1 minute? Any further remarks?
Thank you, Judge. If we could follow up on just one point. With regard to the claim about the injury that Judge Jones read in for the director plaintiffs, that they somehow had suffered as a member of a former board, not only would the position urged by the plaintiffs drastically expand Colorado's standing law, but it would also lead to an absurd result. That would essentially mean that any former director of a board, possibly a founding director, but or certainly a founding director, possibly a former director, would have standing for all of time to challenge the actions of later boards merely by saying they disagreed with a later board decision and that that later board decision didn't comport with the original intention of the founding board.
Well, there is some authority that allows the settler who created the charitable trust some interest down the road, but I don't think it expands to directors.
We agree, Jeff.
Thank you, counsel. Thank all of you for your very helpful arguments in this case. The matter will stand submitted to the court and an opinion will issue in due course.